End-of-life care isn't just expensive for patients and their families. It can also have unexpected consequences if we're not prepared. Our next guest wants all of us to be sure to have conversations with our doctors and our families, not just about how to die, but also about how we should live in the final years and months and weeks of our life. He says a good life deserves a good death. Angelo Volandis is with us. He's a physician and researcher at Harvard Medical School and the author of The Conversation, A Revolutionary Plan for End-of-Life Care. Angelo, welcome to Central Time.
Hey, Veronica. Great to be here.
Well, you say that your years as a doctor have taught you a lot about how not to die. What do you mean by that?
You know, over the years, taking care of patients, I've often found myself asking myself when I'm taking care of a patient, what am I doing? What am I doing to this patient who's being admitted to the hospital? And so often, I think if you talk to enough doctors behind closed doors, all of us have stories where we really question, what are we doing? We got into medicine to do good, to help people. And when it comes to the end of life in America, a lot of us are questioning what's going on in our hospitals. Too often, patients have procedures done on them that if they were more informed, they probably wouldn't want. You know, when we ask people in surveys, where would you like to spend the end of your life? Close to 80%, more than 80% of people say at home, surrounded by their loved ones and in comfort. But what are the facts? Two-thirds of people over 65 end up dying in our hospitals, in our nursing homes, often in pain and often tethered to breathing machines.
So what's going on there? If 80% of people want to die at home with their families around them, not, you know, plugged up with tubes in a hospital, why aren't they dying at home?
Well, I hate to say it, but I think a lot of providers just aren't having these difficult discussions with patients and families about what's important to them at the end of life, about what their hopes are, their fears. We just don't prioritize that in healthcare. As a physician, I was taught many things in medical school. I was taught to be a technical expert with these interventions, taught about reading EKGs and MRIs. But communication training and how to talk to patients is often not prioritized in healthcare.
So it's not prioritized. Does that mean that there's simply not time for it? Is it not part of training? Or is there still something taboo about, even among physicians, about talking about some of these weighted questions about philosophy and living a good life?
Well, I think it's a combination of both. You know, as a physician, I think when I sit down and have these discussions with patients, I necessarily have to confront my own mortality. So I think that's part of it. But, you know, I think the other half is that medical schools just don't prioritize it. And when they do, it's, you know, maybe a couple of lectures throughout a four-year education. And the same thing for residency. We just don't prioritize it as a healthcare system. And especially for physicians who have been out of medical school and residency for 10 years, they never had any training on communication or palliative care classes. So I fear that they are the group who take care of most of patients in America, and they're the ones who probably have conversations the least.
Well, you want to revolutionize, and you use that word yourself. It's a big word, the way Americans deal with end-of-life care. What do we need to do to get there to a better place with communication and understanding toward the end of life?
You know, I think there are two things that we can do to really revolutionize healthcare. The first is to put patients back at the center of healthcare. We often talk about in medicine about patient-centered care. The fact is today we don't have patient-centered care. It's doctor-centered care. It's time to put the patient back in. And I think the way to do that is for patients and families to empower themselves, to learn about their options. And one way that I feel we could really get that going is to have patients learn their options through videos that explain to them what their options are for medical care, what are the questions they should be asking themselves, and the conversations they should be having with their families.
And how do we start those conversations? As you said, people don't necessarily like talking about death. What's one way that we can begin it?
I think one of the most common ways that I tell my patients to start the conversation with their loved ones is just to sit down and say, you know, I'd really like to talk to you about what's important to me, about what a good day is today, and what a good day might be tomorrow. But if I get critically ill, the sort of things I would or wouldn't want, what's important to me, what are my hopes, what are my fears?
So it's as simple as beginning with some very simple questions.
It really is. But it sounds so simple, but it's probably the one of the most difficult interventions in healthcare today.
We're talking right now with Dr. Angela Volandis about end-of-life decision-making and how to have the conversation with doctors, with our families, and with ourselves. And we want to hear from you. What questions do you have for our guests? Have you been through a similar situation over the death of a loved one that we're talking about today? Have you had this type of difficult conversation where you really think clearly about what you would like at the end of your life? Have you seen it go away you didn't like with a loved one and you wish you could change that and you thought about that? Call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert. We're back with Dr. Angela Volandis talking about how to make the best decisions for the end of life. It's a conversation that many people don't have with their physicians. Our guest wants to change that, and he wants us to have a death that is equal to the life that we've lived. And we want to hear from you. Are you uncertain about how to begin that conversation about death and what you'd like and how to make sure that you get what you need? Do you need some tips for making sure that care is coming your way, and how do you get there? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email us at talk@wpr.org. And we take our first caller now. We have Amy joining us from Milwaukee. Hi, Amy.
Hi. This really resonates with me because my dad developed type 2 diabetes, and it went unchecked for quite some time. And I think he was around the age of 73, he started dialysis. And because he didn't live in the same town the dialysis clinic was in, he had to travel. So he would spend about 5 hours every other day, 3 days a week, going to dialysis. And he never really did feel good and ended up having to be taken to a nursing home, moving into a nursing home where he fell and broke his hip. And then they would pick him up with his still really sort of broken hip and put him in a van and transport him to dialysis 3 days a week. And it was just like, it got to the point where it was just awful. He had no quality of life, but no one really talked about not going to dialysis anymore and what that would mean for him. And I'm a baby boomer, and I think a lot of people my age are finding the same thing happening with their aging parents. The conversations aren't being had, but there's lots of medicine and lots of ways to keep them alive and extend their lives. And so it was really devastating for our family, that whole thing.
Thank you so much for sharing that, Amy. And I'm sorry to hear about what your father and your family went through. And I know, Dr. Volandis, that this is not a completely unique story. Amy talking about quality of life as something that didn't really take precedence at the end of her father's life. When you hear a story like that, what comes to mind?
Thanks, Amy, for calling. You know, what comes to mind is my own dad, who had uncontrolled diabetes as well. You know, listening to Amy, I was listening to my own story because no one ever asked him what's important to him. And so often, patients don't know their options. So especially when it comes to kidney disease, no one says, you know, you don't have to do the hemodialysis. There are other options. And it's because all of us as physicians are trained to do the next greatest thing. You know, we have so many fixes in medicine. We have our toolkit and we try to throw everything at patients. But sometimes we have to know what fixes we shouldn't use. And the only way to know that is to have a conversation with a patient. And I think the description that Amy presented of her dad is something that I've experienced, but that millions of people experience. And I think we're really going to hear many, many more stories like this because baby boomers are indeed taking care of their loved ones and are facing this each and every day.
So let's look at that kind of story right now. Let's say someone is going through something like that that's really degrading their quality of life. What are some other options that would be available?
So, for instance, for patients whose kidneys are failing them, a very common situation, most people think, well, I have to do hemodialysis. Actually, that's not the case. There are other ways, something called supportive care, where a physician actually takes care of you with medications, does the best he or she can without having to go on hemodialysis. You know, the funny thing is that when we look at large studies of people over the age of 75 and who are in nursing homes, for those who start hemodialysis, there's actually no benefit in terms of their survival compared to not starting dialysis. It's really, really interesting work that continues to be developed through research. And we also know in many other studies that people who choose a more comfort-oriented path ironically often live longer than those who don't.
I want to get to more callers, but just to follow up on that quickly, what do you think went wrong there with not all the options not being laid out on the table?
Well, I think there's two things. First, many clinicians, and I'm going to speak as a doctor now, many of us just don't know what the options are. And so we just assume dialysis is the only option. You know, the national guidelines by the National Kidney Foundation state that for older people who have kidney failure, you know, hemodialysis is one option, but there are many other options in addition to dialysis. And I think the other part of that equation is patients don't know their options. And so if a patient doesn't know their option, they're just going to go along with the doctor because they don't know any better. And that's the part of the revolution in the title of the book is we need to flip the power here between the patient and the doctor. Right now, if the doctor doesn't talk about it, the patient doesn't hear it. Well, it's time that the patient understood their options and bring it back to the doctor and say, hey, I know what my options are, and I want to talk about them.
Let's go next to Allison. Allison's joining us from Ashland. Hi there.
Hi there.
What would you like to share?
Yeah, I'm actually a medical student at the University of Wisconsin. I'm in my fourth year now. And over winter break, I sat down and talked with my aging grandparents. They're 95 and 96 years old. And their physician had never thought that it was important to talk with them about end-of-life care. And they'd never done anything like fill a DNR, DNI form out. That was really surprising to me to be at the point where you're almost 100 years old and no one's ever talked to you about what you want at the end of your life.
And do you see this, Ashley, or Allison, I'm sorry, is something that's changing?
You know, I certainly hope so. I see that within my own class. We're taught to ask about things like, do you have a power of attorney set up? Do you have wishes for your medical care from the very first time that we talk with patients? And I know that's something a lot of my classmates and I are really passionate about doing. So I hope as this next generation of physicians begins to take over, that will be something that's prioritized, because I think it's important to talk to people about what their desires are at the end of life.
Allison, thank you so much for the call. Appreciate that. And Dr. Volandis, do you see this as a cultural shift that may be already happening?
Absolutely. It's great to hear of students like Allison and the new crop of medical students and residents where they are being taught to have the conversation. They're being told this is just as important as talking about what medications a patient's on, what allergies they have. You need to ask them about what's important to them and what sort of medical care they do or don't want at the end of life. I'm very optimistic. It's just right now there's so many people who are suffering because of this that I wish those new medical students and residents could be taking care of all patients.
Well, thanks again for that call. On to Melanie we go, joining us in Madison. Melanie, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm currently taking care of my sister at end of life, and it's in home, but we have hospice, and she has an amazing doctor when it comes to palliative care. But I'm still wondering if there are, you know, if there might be things that I'm missing. For example, one of her biggest concerns is, you know, how do I console her when she says, I'm leaving you with such a mess? I don't want that to be the last thought that is weighing on her.
Okay, some interesting questions there. Melanie, thank you so much for sharing that with us, and I'm glad the palliative care is going well. But what about some of those emotional needs? How do we make sure they're attended to, Dr. Volandis?
Absolutely. Thanks, Melanie, for calling. I think it's important for all of us to recognize that this is a team effort, and it's not just physicians who help patients at the end of life. It's actually social workers, therapists, nurses, chaplains. It's a true team effort. And what we know specifically about hospice care is that it meets the emotional and spiritual needs of not only patients, but also the family. So it really is a holistic approach to taking care of people at the end of life. So I would encourage Melanie to talk to the chaplain, to the therapist, to the psychologist, to the social worker and nurse who's part of her team taking care of her sister.
Well, thank you so much, Melanie, and good luck to you and to your sister. And one more quick call here from Cameron in La Crosse. Hi there, Cameron.
Hi, how's it going?
It's going well. What would you like to share?
I'm a nurse, and I've been an ICU nurse for 10 years, and I'm currently a DMP student at the University of Minnesota, and we are trying to facilitate nurses to get into some of these positions of power in healthcare because the backbone of nursing has always been patient preference and patient-centered care. And I just wondered what your guests might have to say about getting some nurses and advanced practice nurses involved in this this kind of palliative care, end-of-life care push.
Okay, thank you so much for that question. And Dr. Verlandes, what would you say to that? How can nurses be part of this?
I don't think nurses can be part of it. I think they're the solution to this. Nurses are better communicators. Nurses see my patients far more frequently and often than I do throughout the day or their stay in the hospital. I think the solution starts with nurses, and I think all of us have to recognize that it's the complete healthcare team led by nurses who are really going to transform healthcare by starting this conversation. It's the nurses who see the suffering, who see the toll of not having these discussions. And I really salute Cameron and all nurses to be the leaders in this field and to feel empowered that they could start these conversations with their patients.
Cameron, thank you so much for that call. And Dr. Verlandes, before we let you go, I know that a passion of yours is using film to try to help inform patients so that they can make decisions about the end of their lives and what they'd like. How do you recommend using film and maybe yours to get to that place of understanding?
You know, what we know around the country is that some clinicians are good at having this conversation and some aren't. And it's unfortunate because you might be in a part of the country where not many clinicians actually do have these conversations. Well, we don't think you should suffer because you don't have access to these conversations. So what we've done is leverage video technology to help people how to start the conversation. So as part of the book, we have a video. It's at www.theconversationbook.org, which helps people have the conversation for themselves and to become empowered. It standardizes the process. It helps everybody have the conversation.
Well, thank you so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
We've been speaking with Angelo Verlandes. He's the author of The Conversation, A Revolutionary Plan for End-of-Life Care. He's also founder of Advanced Care Planning Decisions, a nonprofit organization devoted to encouraging the conversation.